Our sermon series through the Gospel of John brings us this morning to chapter 7, verses 10 through 24. Last week we covered the first part of the chapter where you may recall Jesus' brothers were frustrated that he, who apparently thought he was or wanted to be the Messiah, was wasting time in Galilee when he should be showing himself to the world. The place to do that was Jerusalem. The time to do that was a feast, such as Tabernacles, which was at hand. Perfect opportunity, it seemed to them, to show the world he was the real deal. Why wasn't he doing that? He told them, verse 6, "My time has not yet come, but your time is always ready. You go up to this feast. I am not yet going up to this feast, for my time has not yet fully come." We talked about their expectations, the script they had for the Messiah, and how Jesus wasn't fulfilling that script. We know in retrospect, as only Jesus knew at the time, that their script was incomplete. It only told part of the story. The part it told was of the glory of the Messiah. The part that was missing was of the suffering of the Messiah. Well, in this next passage, we'll see Jesus actually does go to Jerusalem to go to the Feast of Tabernacles, but he does so in a time and manner of his own choosing. He travels privately and arrives tardily. We'll explain why in a bit, but let's read through John chapter 7, verses 10 through 24. "But when his brothers had gone up, then he also went up to the feast, not openly, but as it were in secret. Then the Jews sought him at the feast and said, 'Where is he?' But there was much complaining among the people concerning him. Some said, 'He is good.' Others said, 'No, on the contrary, he deceives the people.' However, no one spoke openly of him for fear of the Jews. Now about the middle of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and taught. And the Jews marveled, saying, 'How does this man know letters, having never studied?' Jesus answered them and said, 'My doctrine is not mine, but his who sent me. If anyone wills to do his will, he shall know concerning the doctrine, whether it is from God or whether I speak on my own authority. He who speaks from himself seeks his own glory, but he who seeks the glory of the one who sent him is true, and no unrighteousness is in him. Did not Moses give you the law? Yet none of you keeps the law. Why do you seek to kill me?' The people answered and said, 'You have a demon. Who is seeking to kill you?' Jesus answered and said to them, 'I did one work, and you all marvel. Moses therefore gave you circumcision, not that it is from Moses, but from the fathers, and you circumcise a man on the Sabbath. If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath, so that the law of Moses should not be broken, are you angry with me because I made a man completely well on the Sabbath? Do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment.'" The last line, verse 24, "Do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment," is where we'll camp. The practical point will pursue an application, but before we apply it to ourselves, we want to understand how it applies to them. See how they were judging by appearance rather than with righteous judgment. And I'm tempted to say unfortunately, though it's not unfortunate, it's just a fact, for a variety of reasons, this passage requires some explanation. It's on the less transparent side of the scale. So we'll go over it thoroughly, be sure we understand their problem, how they were judging according to appearance. Then we'll look in the mirror, see what we need to know, feel, and do to judge with righteous judgment rather than by appearance. So, John chapter 7, verse 10. "When his brothers had gone up, then he also went up to the feast, not openly, but as it were in secret. His brothers wanted him to show himself to the world, but it wasn't time yet." Within John's account, that time is 5 chapters away. The triumphal entry, Palm Sunday, which John records in chapter 12. By calendar time, it is 6 months away at the next feast of Passover. So Jesus travels to this feast, Tabernacles, not openly, but as it were in secret. This is not some undercover mystery or grand subterfuge. It's for the same reason celebrities often disguise themselves in public. They just don't want to create a scene. There were three annual feasts when virtually everybody gathered at Jerusalem: Passover, First Fruits, and Tabernacles. And because everybody had to be at the same place at the same time, they traveled in very large groups, hundreds or thousands of people moving together. We catch a glimpse of this in the one boyhood account we get of Jesus told in Luke chapter 2. It's where he stayed behind at the temple. It was the feast of Passover. His family, in a big group, had walked from Nazareth to Jerusalem, participated in the feast, and then turned around to walk back. Luke chapter 2, verse 43. When they had finished the days, as they returned, the boy Jesus lingered behind in Jerusalem, and Joseph and his mother did not know it. But supposing him to have been in the company, they went a day's journey and sought him among their relatives and acquaintances. So when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem. Parents, imagine losing your 12-year-old child for an entire day while you're on a trip and not even knowing it. Sounds crazy to us, but it wasn't for them because they routinely traveled in these large groups. Mary and Joseph assumed Jesus was somewhere in the group. Took him a day to realize he was not. Well, grown-up Jesus did not travel to this feast in one of the large groups coming from Galilee. If he had, everybody in the group would have known he was with the group, and all the other groups would have known that was the Jesus group, and they would have measured themselves by how far ahead or how far behind the Jesus group they were. This is also why he probably arrived late. He, and presumably his disciples, traveled a day or two behind these larger groups. Verses 11 through 13. Then the Jews sought him at the feast and said, "Where is he?" And there was much complaining among the people concerning him. Some said, "He is good." Others said, "No, on the contrary, he deceives the people." However, no one spoke openly of him for fear of the Jews. Verse 12. There was much complaining among the people concerning Jesus. The word translated complaining there in the New King James is rendered grumbling in the New American Standard, muttering in the ESV, and widespread whispering in the NIV. The Old King James has the wonderfully evocative murmuring. Two things are going on. One, there is an argument about Jesus. Some are saying he's good, others saying no, he's bad. Again, referencing last week, Jesus frustrates their expectations. He's off script. Some people see that and go, "Hey, case closed. This guy's bad." Others, looking at it, go, "You know, I think there's something else going on here." A little later in John, chapter 10, verse 20, many will say of him, "He has a demon and is mad. Why do you listen to him?" But others respond, "These are not the words of one who has a demon. Can a demon open the eyes of the blind?" They were processing the dilemma Jesus presented. And it was a dilemma. There was no middle ground. You had to choose either for him or against him. That's one thing that's going on. The other is that they're all doing this under the radar. They're whispering, muttering, murmuring this debate, because the authorities have already made their choice about Jesus. They have already decided against him. Verse 13, no one spoke openly of him for fear of the Jews. Which brings us to another confounding factor in this passage. I just called them the authorities, but that's not what Jesus, or what John calls them. He calls them the Jews. Verse 12, there was much complaining among the people concerning Jesus. Verse 13, however, no one spoke openly of him for fear of the Jews. Which is weird because the people are just as Jewish as the Jews are. In the context, Jesus, his disciples, the crowd, the authority, everybody's Jewish. But he, tends to call the leaders the authorities, the Jews. What's called elsewhere, the other writers, Pharisees and the Sadducees, the scribes and the teachers of the law, the Sanhedrin, the religious powers that be, John just collectively calls the Jews. He's been doing this all along, but it really begins to show in this passage, and there's a number of interesting points to be made about it, but they're not our concern today. So I'm just noting it, and then proceeding to another confounding factor which proceeds from that. Here's the situation. Jesus did not arrive publicly at the Feast of Tabernacles. Everybody was talking about him, everybody was looking for him, but as far as they knew, he wasn't there. Then he suddenly appears in the middle of the feast on center stage, right in the temple, teaching. Verse 14, now about the middle of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and taught. And the Jews marveled, saying, how does this man know letters, having never studied? Note, it's the Jews, read the authorities there. They're the ones who marvel. Jesus' reply begins in verse 16, but because I'm just trying to show you the framework, skip to the last line of his reply, which is the end of verse 19. Why do you seek to kill me? Verse 20, the people answered and said, you have a demon who is seeking to kill you. Note there, it's the people who say that. Jesus replies, verse 21, I did one work and you all marvel, then proceeds to talk about circumcision on the Sabbath, wrapping up with the admonition, do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. Everything clear? Good. Now, seriously, in order to bring this into focus, you have to recognize it is not a dialogue, it is a trialogue. In other words, there are three parties involved. Jesus, the people, that is the crowd, and what John calls the Jews, by which he means the authorities. This is a three-way interchange, and what they're talking about is what happened back in John chapter 5, which was the last time in John's narrative, Jesus was in Jerusalem at a feast. He healed a man at the pool of Bethesda, had been infirm 38 years, just said, rise, take up your bed and walk. He rose, took up his bed and walked. Wonder of wonder, miracle of miracles, except, dun 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 dun, he had done it on the Sabbath. John 5:16, for this reason, the authorities, the Jews, persecuted Jesus and sought to kill him because he had done these things on the Sabbath. Now, the people, that is the crowd, since the authorities were lining up against Jesus, that's why they were keeping their discussion quiet, murmuring about him for fear of the Jews, but they did not know, could not have imagined, the authorities had already decided to kill Jesus. This is why in our text, when Jesus says, verse 19, why do you seek to kill me? The people respond, you have a demon. Who is seeking to kill you? Well, the authorities are. But they, the people, do not know that yet. In this three-way conversation, you might picture Jesus looking the authorities in the eye as he says, why do you seek to kill me? But the crowd, oblivious to the authorities' plan, goes, well, what's up with you? Who's trying to kill you? You must have a demon. Little do they know. Well, there are even more layers to this fascinating onion. But in order to arrive at practical land, where we'll be in a few minutes, we'll stop here. Just recognize there is a three-way interchange going on. The people don't know. The Jews, that is the authorities, have already decided to kill Jesus. But Jesus does know that. The reason he talks about the Sabbath is because that was the issue back in John chapter 5. Now, the Sabbath, you probably get, it's fourth of the Ten Commandments, Exodus 20, verse 8 and following. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work. But what does circumcision have to do with any of this? Circumcision was the covenant sign for every Jewish male. It was in the law of Moses, but it didn't start there. It began before that. The Lord said to Abraham, Genesis 17, verse 10, This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you. He who is 8 days old among you shall be circumcised, every male child. Simple enough. But what do you do with a male child born on a Friday? Because their eighth day is a Sabbath. And approximately one out of every seven males is born on Friday. I'm just speaking from memory on that. But what you have is two elemental obligations. One, Sabbath observance, and the other, circumcision. They could and regularly did come into conflict. Oy vey! Did you ever have to make up your mind? Say yes to one and leave the other behind. It's not often easy and it's not often kind. But they had to make up their mind. So they did. They decided circumcision trumped Sabbath. It just did. Just forget about it. That's how we do it. So they solved this regularly occurring and elemental problem by circumcising on the Sabbath. Case closed. Back to the narrative in John 7. They're discussing the conflict that arose the last time they were all together. That's at the Feast of Passover 6 months ago, where Jesus healed the guy on the Sabbath, and the authorities wanted to kill him because he'd done it on the Sabbath. That's the background of the trialogue in our passage, and for Jesus' reasoning in verses 22 and 23. Moses therefore gave you circumcision, not that it was from Moses, but from the fathers, and you circumcise a man on the Sabbath. If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath, so that the law of Moses should not be broken, are you angry with me because I made a man completely well on the Sabbath? The authorities were claiming he couldn't be from God because he broke the Sabbath. He is reminding them of something they have overlooked. Namely, that they regularly do this when they circumcise a male on the Sabbath. Circumcision is fixing one part of the body. How can they object to him fixing, healing the whole body on the Sabbath? So, in sum, Jesus discreetly attends the Feast of Tabernacles. He knew his time was nearing, but had not arrived yet. He was purposefully keeping a lid on things. The people were excited. They're jawing back and forth. Is he? Isn't he? But the authorities have already decided he isn't. And they're thinking about how to do away with him. The people didn't know that, but Jesus did. And he suddenly comes to his temple teaching. And as soon as the authorities engage him, they resume in a three-way conversation right where they'd left off 6 months ago. Did that ever happen to you, like at family gatherings? Because in my family, you could have an argument at Christmas, and then come Easter, it'd pick it up like, you know, everybody had just stepped out for a bathroom break, you know. I don't know, maybe my family was weird. Anyway, Jesus' point, the conclusion of his message to both the people and the authorities is John 7:24. Do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. According to appearance, he broke the Sabbath, he's bad. But they wouldn't have to think very hard or look very far to see it wasn't as simple as that. Just think about circumcision on the Sabbath. Well, the authorities don't want to think about circumcision on the Sabbath because the authorities aren't interested in righteous judgment. They're interested in appearing to be interested in righteous judgment, but they aren't actually interested in it, which is the whole problem. Appearance versus reality. Upton Sinclair put it this way: it is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on not understanding it. He's just talking about a schmuck in a bureaucracy who's interested in keeping his desk tidy and his paycheck coming. And in order to do that, he needs to appear to be interested in your problem. But it's all for show. Whether it's the Water Bureau or the insurance company or the IRS, he doesn't actually want to deal with your problem because that would monkey wrench his whole routine. But he does want to appear to deal with your problem and keep the paperwork in order and refer you to the Department of Referrals, which is two flights up on the right, to get you out of his hair. And the example that I use shows I'm of an age to still think of this in 20th century terms of buildings and going two flights up. The technology has changed, but human nature hasn't. The current equivalent of this is being shuffled through the phone tree, beep, ba beep, ba beep, where every person you can actually talk to simply tells you they're not the person you need to talk to, I'll transfer you, click. Nothing new under the sun. Well, this very common human dynamic is writ large on the pages of the gospel. The authorities have no interest in actually understanding Jesus. They understand him well enough to know he'll blow their world apart. But they are interested in appearing to understand, which is why they like judging by appearances. They don't want to look below the surface because the way it appears on the surface suits their purpose, which is to get rid of Jesus. It's a sad truth that they were not interested in righteous judgment. But we are. Or should be. So, having filled in the background of their situation enough to understand the message, let's fast forward 2,000 years, come to practical land, and ask how it applies to us. Jesus says to us, do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. A couple of quick points. We have to get the obligatory judge not qualification out of the way. Our postmodern relativistic age likes to cherry-pick Jesus' teaching in order to appear to have his endorsement on the surface, and the biggest, juiciest cherry to pick is found in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 7, verse 1, where Jesus says, judge not that you not be judged. Case closed. Jesus said, do not judge anything ever. Well, that's sort of what he said on the surface. You don't have to look far below to see what they'd like his words to mean is not, in fact, what he meant. All you have to do is keep reading Matthew 7, verse 2 and following. For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. And why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye and do not consider the plank in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me remove the speck from your eye, and look, there is a plank in your own eye? Hypocrite! First remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's. Even within that little snippet of five verses, his meaning is clearly not, don't judge anything ever. In his explanation, he doesn't say, don't remove the speck from your brother's eye. He says, hypocrite, first remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's. Self-righteous judgment. Judgment which sees all the sin out there, but never looks in the mirror to see the sin, the plank, in here. That's what Jesus is talking about. To spin that into don't judge anything ever is a recipe for personal and social suicide, which the world around us seems eagerly bent on pursuing. The very same Jesus who tells us in Matthew 7, 1, to judge not, that we not be judged, tells us in John 7, 24, to judge with righteous judgment. Yes, it's the same word. Happens to be in exactly the same grammatical form, a present active imperative, which means it's a command. Jesus commands us to judge with righteous judgment in the same way And to the same degree, he commands us to judge not, that we not be judged. You do not have to look far below the surface to reconcile these things, but you do have to look below the surface, and that presupposes you want to look below the surface, and that's the point. Whether the authorities in his own day or people hijacking his brand in our day, they're not interested in looking below the surface because they're not interested in righteous judgment. They're just interested in having things appear a certain way. But what does righteous judgment mean? Sounds pretty judgmental. Frankly, the word is flexible enough that it may simply mean correct rather than incorrect. The NIV translates, stop judging by mere appearances and make a right judgment. The New Living Translation, look beneath the surface so you can judge correctly. They're taking it in that simple correct, incorrect way. The New American Standard, in this instance, reads exactly like the New King James, which I use, do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment, leaves open that more authoritative implication. And you know what? We'll leave that hanging. I'm going to let you work that out, because we're going to focus on the point which has no ambiguity. Do not judge according to appearance. Stop judging by mere appearance. Look beneath the surface. That's the New Living Translation. Look beneath the surface. And I think that's an apt rephrasing of the meaning in contemporary terms. Look beneath the surface. And that's not shocking or surprising, because you don't have to have lived very long to understand, for any number of reasons, the way things appear may be very different from the way that they are. But to tell the difference, you're going to have to look beneath the surface. When the Lord sent Samuel to anoint one of Jesse's sons as the new king, even one as great as Samuel, and he was great, but even he initially judged by appearance. Jesse's firstborn son was named Eliab, and he must have looked the part, because when Jesse brought seven of his sons before the prophet, Samuel just looked at Eliab and said, well, he's our guy, right? Starts reaching for the oil to anoint him. The Lord says, whoa, 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 1 Samuel 16:7, do not look at his appearance or at his physical stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord does not see as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. On the surface, by outward appearance, Eliab was the guy. Interestingly, we're not given any specifics about his appearance. We just infer from Samuel's reaction, he must have looked like a king, tall rather than short, strong rather than weak, handsome rather than homely. You call central casting, tell them you need a king, they're going to send you somebody who looked like Eliab, somebody who looks the part. But the Lord does not see as man sees, and that's not because he sees less than we do. He sees more. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks beneath the surface. The Lord looks at the heart. In the history of Israel, they'd already tried somebody who looked like a king. His name was Saul. He was handsome. 1 Samuel 9:2 says, there was no one more handsome in Israel. And he was tall. The same verse says he stood head and shoulders above everybody else. My, oh my, yes siree, no doubt about it. He sure looks like a king. If being a king were a beauty contest, he'd have won hands down. But it's not a beauty contest. It's a character contest. It's not about how you look outside. It's about how you are inside. One of the many problems of judging by experience is that we don't have a reliable scale. We may think we do, but we don't really. One time, sitting by the treasury in the temple, Jesus was watching people put money in. And there were a lot of rich people putting in a lot of money. Then a poor woman, a widow, came and tossed in two small coins, mites, my translation calls them. A mite was a very small coin. It is like less than a penny, if you can imagine that. I have an authentic one here. You can come up and take a look at it afterwards if you'd like. It ain't much. But she put in two of these. And Jesus saw her. And when he saw her, he called his disciples over. And he said, you know, she just put in more than everybody else. He didn't say more than any of the others. He wasn't comparing her to them individually. He said she put in more than all the others. He was comparing her to them collectively. He went on to explain, Mark 12:44, for they all put in out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, put in all that she had. Though by outward appearance it's almost nothing, beneath the surface, by true measure, it was everything. Looked up Bill Gates' net worth yesterday. $89.9 billion. Let's just call it 90. Why quibble over $10 million? So everything the widow had was two mites. Everything Bill Gates has is $90 billion. So it might seem like one of these would be equivalent to $45 billion for Bill Gates. Might seem like that, but it's not. Because if Bill Gates gave away $45 billion, he'd still have $45 billion left to live on. And the thing that made the widow's mite so valuable is that it was everything, all she had. Bill Gates could not possibly give more than she did. But if he wanted to equal her, ascend to the height she had already attained, he would have to give away all $90 billion. Then, and only then, would $45 billion of his dollars be worth one of these. It's a strange sort of economy when you look beneath the surface. Kind of confusing, kind of disturbing. And that's another reason we can prefer to judge by appearances. It's easier. You don't have to think. The appearance tells you what to think. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. I have found this message rather difficult to apply, in particular. I work on a sermon for a couple of weeks, so I've been thinking about it a while. Obviously, we judge, we reach conclusions about people and situations by the way things appear. That's where we have to start. That's not the problem. The problem is stopping there, because we do not know what's in someone's heart. We do not know what's happening behind the curtain. Pathetic woman tossed in two little coins. Why bother? Reasonable question on the surface. I saw a t-shirt a few years ago that stuck with me. It had writing on it, which I noted and remember. It read, "I didn't say it was your fault. I said I was going to blame you." Fault and blame were in caps. I didn't say it was your fault. I said I was going to blame you. How quick we are, and how pleasant it is to get the blame assigned. In 2007, a best-selling book was published with this title, Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. Once the blame has been assigned, we can relax. No need to kick over rocks or ask inconvenient questions. Since Jesus' command to look below the surface and judge correctly applies to everything, it's almost misleading to apply it to anything in particular, because it's like that would put blinders on. So I will close with this observation. One of the many problems of judging by appearances is that you're going to get stuck there. The authorities knew Jesus was not what they were portraying him as, but they didn't care. They just wanted to dispose of this very inconvenient fellow so they could, they imagined, get back to business as usual, which was following God, or appearing to follow God, as they had before Jesus showed up. But they did not understand the very act of railroading Jesus affected them, changed them, stuck them at the level of appearance. As was common Roman practice, Jesus, when he was crucified, was done so by a highway. I mean, it's a foot highway, but it's on a main road. They like them nice and visible. Reading from Matthew 27, beginning at verse 29, those who passed by blasphemed him, wagging their heads and saying, "You who destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." Likewise, the chief priests also, mocking with the scribes and the elders, said, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. If he is the king of Israel, let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe him." Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe him. Well, Jesus did not come down from the cross, and they did not believe him. Jesus got buried, and 3 days later, his tomb was empty. What the chief priests and the scribes and the elders believed about that is an intriguing and elusive question. Whatever they believed, we know what they did. They had set a guard on the tomb of Jesus, and when it turned up empty the third day, reading now from Matthew 28, verse 11, some of the guard came into the city and reported to the chief priests all the things that had happened. When they had assembled with the elders and consulted together, they gave a large sum of money to the soldiers, saying, "Tell them his disciples came at night and stole him away while we slept. And if this comes to the governor's ears, we will appease him and make you secure." So they took the money and did as they were instructed. And this saying is commonly reported among the Jews until this day. In other words, they invented a cover story. The tomb actually was empty, and they knew it was empty. And whatever they thought was true, they knew their cover story wasn't. But they produced it and paid for it and put it out there just to keep up appearances. It's a hazardous thing choosing to judge by appearance, refusing to look below the surface. It can get away from you. And before you know it, you find yourself manufacturing appearances, producing appearances to cover up the fact that you've judged by appearances. Not a good loop to get into. Far better as we interact with people and as we evaluate situations to do as Jesus commands, not judge by appearance, look beneath the surface, and judge correctly. Let's pray. Lord, each and every one of us in some way and maybe many, many ways needs to take these words to heart. Would you show us, help us to become more like you, and to see and to value and to act on the reality rather than the appearance. We pray in your name, Jesus. Amen.